coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
A paradigm shift involves the interruption of conceptual continuity within science. And it involves some kind of revolutionary science interrupting the concepts that have been continuously told are facts. So that's what a paradigm shift means. And when we look at psychedelic-assisted therapy and the way in which it prioritizes the inner healer, we are very much doing the reverse of what traditional forms of managing addiction will do. And we are empowering the substance user rather than saying, you have no ability to make decisions. You are at your lowest low. You need to find a higher power in order to recover, which is what the 12 steps encourages. We are saying that higher power is within you. We, as in the psychedelic assisted therapy. And that in itself is a paradigm shift and very much troubles our categories around care.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Today on the show, I'm interviewing my colleague at Maya, Jessica Kadosh. She is our research manager for public health, and this has been a wonderful opportunity for me and you, our audience, to get to know her. On the show, we discuss Jessica's master's research in psychedelics and addiction. We talk about the paradigm shift in care she sees between the concept of the powerless addict and the idea of the empowered inner healer. We also discuss psychedelic societies, of which Jessica is an executive director in Montreal. Finally, we touch on psychedelic ethics, a passion Jessica and I both share. Jessica is currently completing her master's degree in medical anthropology at McGill University. She is the executive director of the Montreal Psychedelic Society and is our research manager here at Maya. Her master's research explores the implications involved in a shifting paradigm around psychedelic substances, particularly relating to 12-step-based models of recovery from addiction. And now, here is Jessica. Okay. So my angle here on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast today is to interview you, my colleague, around the value of psychedelic therapy and around changing mindsets from prohibition, drugs are bad, just say no mindset to the healing power of psychedelic medicine, even for something that you wouldn't necessarily associate with psychedelics as healing, something along the lines of drug addiction. It's kind of an interesting thing for people to wrap their heads around. And you've done research on this topic, so I'm super interested to learn about that. And then also, I'm just very interested to learn about you because I work with you, but we work remotely. We're a distributed team. We've only known each other a few months. And there's a lot about your background and your love of psychedelics that I have yet to glean. So glean I shall on this episode of the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. How does that sound to you?
That sounds lovely. I'm really looking forward to it.
This is your first time being on a podcast. Is that correct?
It is.
Do you listen to podcasts? Are you a podcast aficionado?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I love listened to a lot of psychedelics today when I was starting my master's. And I've been listening to your podcast a lot lately.
Well, I do believe you mean our podcast.
Our podcast. Yeah.
And of course, Psychedelics Today is an amazing podcast. I've been on that show myself. Two great interviewers, Kyle and Joe. And you're going to be on the Psychedelics Today podcast as well. How did that go down? Are they interested in the research that you're doing, your work with Maya? How did that interview get teed up?
Well, I met Joe and Kyle at Horizons in 2019. And we hung out, I think it was at the Symposia after party in Brooklyn, and we ended up sharing a cab together, and we just hit it off real nice. So I just always like to maintain those relationships. And I got on a call with Joe recently just to kind of catch up and see what's going on with him, what's happening with psychedelics today, specifically trying to learn a little bit more about their education program. And then we just got talking. And, you know, when we met in 2019, we had mentioned bringing me on the podcast. And so that was that.
Nice. And you're quite involved in psychedelic communities as well. You are the founder of the Montreal Psychedelic Society. Is that the case?
Gonzo founded it about 4 or 5 years ago. And our friend Gonzo left to Toronto. And when he left, he handed it over to my previous colleague, Ariella. And she was doing a great job holding it together. But she started to move into the world of harm reduction more generally. I was working with harm reduction organizations and was taking less of an interest in psychedelics. So I felt as I was volunteering with them and as I was feeling a kind of yearning to get more involved with my own community, after having spent about 4 months in the San Francisco Psychedelic Society for my research, I felt it only made sense for me to start getting the Montreal Psychedelic Society moving a little bit more. And so basically, I just added a few more people to the board, and now I'm the executive director. And honestly, there's not much that I need to do because the team is so amazing. Everybody really takes care of the things that's needed. I kind of just get everybody together into one space.
Nice. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about the proliferation of psychedelic societies, because that's actually something that I'm aware of, but I don't belong to any psychedelic societies, and there's so many of them, and I'm interested to chat with you a little bit about that today. But first, let us start at the beginning, where these conversations so often start, which is, why psychedelics? What drew you into this technicolored dream world that has this incredible healing potential, but also this sort of splendid psycho-spiritual opportunity abounding as well? What got you into psychedelics?
Yeah, I really love sharing this story, because sharing the story, I think, is also part of my healing process and the way that I can, as I continue to make it part of who I am, that kind of just confounds and becomes a domino effect. So here goes, here's the story. You know, I started experimenting with psychedelics when I was about 16 years old, quite young. And, you know, like most people who are experimenting with psychedelics at that age, we're not really taught in North America how to hold them with such respect, and you're using them to have fun. And that I did have fun. And I found that a lot of my friends were having difficult experiences, and I was often finding myself as the person who was often taking care of those who were having difficult experiences. And, you know, I got very into the world of taking psychedelics, and I may have even perhaps abused them to a certain degree, taking them quite a bit. And at the same time, you know, now I'm about 19 years old. I had a best friend, her name was also Jessica, who was getting into opiates and was developing a heroin addiction. And I was very much of the thought style of, my drugs are better than your drugs. Why don't you take LSD with me? Why don't you take mushrooms with me instead of doing your bad drugs? And very much pushed her away from me. And over time, she eventually overdosed on fentanyl. And we lost our dear friend, Bobes, is what we called her. And that was really difficult for us, you know, being 20 years old at that point and experiencing that. And, you know, now a lot of us, the friends, what we do today is in honor of her. But when I experienced that, I realized that I didn't know anything about addiction at all. And I had never been taught anything about addiction. And fast forward about, you know, 4 years later, I had a partner who I was with for a very long time, and he was struggling with cocaine and alcohol addiction. And we decided that it was best for him to go into a 12-step program. And he was doing very well in the 12-step program. It was about a 40-day clinic. And I remember when I went to go visit him one day, he turned to me with very concerned eyes and said, if I stop using cocaine and alcohol, am I allowed to use mushrooms to connect with my friends in the forest and connect with myself and connect with my spirit? Is that considered a relapse? He said to me. And at the time, all I knew about addiction was what happened with Bobes when, you know, she had overdosed on fentanyl. And I didn't know what to say to him. I didn't have an answer. Because technically, with the 12-step program, is you have to be completely abstinent in order to be considered sober, in order to be considered in recovery. And so that was when I had this aha moment. It was actually shortly after that, I went to go see Catherine McLean at the Montreal Psychedelic Society. This is when I was first starting to get involved with volunteering for them. And she was talking a lot about integration and teaching me, showing me for the first time that there's a lot of research being done on using psychedelics to treat addiction and various mental illnesses. And that's when I had an aha moment and realized, okay, I'm going to go apply for a master's degree in medical anthropology, because my background was in cultural anthropology. And this kind of seemed very pertinent to medicine and different ways that we approach medicine as a culture.
Can you define medical anthropology, please?
I'll try my best. Well, anthropology would be the study of humans, past and present, across time and across space. And so medical anthropology would be the study of how humans are engaging with medicine across time, across space, in different ways.
So it's not studying medicine itself, it's studying the way that humans culturally interact with medicine, the way that medicines sort of move through different cultural shifts within human societies. Would that be accurate?
I think so. I think when it comes to social sciences and something like anthropology, it's really difficult to pinpoint exactly one definition. There's so many amazing anthropologists that are studying very nuanced things. And I think some people might end up studying actual, you know, what is the efficacy of certain medicine types. But generally, it would be in the human interaction with this type of medicine.
And so you pursued a master's degree in medical anthropology with a focus on addiction and drug use. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah. So for my master's, there's a thesis. The first year is a lot of social theory work that you do. And the second, and then in the summertime, you go and you conduct field work. And I conducted my field work in San Francisco. And then you write your thesis. And that's what the master's program is at McGill University, where I'm at here in Montreal. And so my project the whole time from day one was to do this exact research.
So I can see some real value here for the psychedelic therapists and healers listening to this program at the moment, who are themselves hoping to shift paradigms and who are themselves hoping to have better language to move forward psychedelics as healing. Are you familiar with the term pharmacon?
I'm not.
Okay, it's the word that pharmacy comes from. A pharmacon is something that can either heal you or harm you. It's a thing that is both. You know, it's used a certain way, it's a poison. Used a certain way, it's healing. And I think that psychedelic medicine can be looked at that way. Particularly, I'd say something like a ketamine, which can be an addictive molecule and can cause harm. So this idea of the pharmacon, this thing that depending on how you look at it, depending how you use it, depending on how it's understood and how it's held culturally, can be one or the other. So I just wanted to drop that in because I think that's an interesting aspect of the shifting perspectives. We can actually change something from a poison to a medicine by the way we think about it, by the way we hold it culturally. And I'm guessing, and you are nodding, so I feel like I'm accurate in guessing this, that part of your study has been about how to change those perspectives. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, you know, the first spark of interest into this research was looking into whether or not someone who is in 12-step recovery can ethically or legitimately use psychedelics for spiritual purposes and still be considered quote unquote in recovery. And so it seems at first like a very nuanced and very particular question. But then when you start looking into it, there's so many people who have been part of these long-term 12-step programs in many, many years of recovery who are now looking at psychedelics, who now the society and culture is telling them, you know, you could use these substances and in a medical way, and it's okay. And what's happening is that it's shaking the fabric of a lot of what they were told is okay and is not okay. And so just in that very, very nuanced example, we see how this shifting narrative has impacts on people's lives and how it's happening through pop culture with books such as Michael Pollan's, for example, which became extremely popular. And people would pick up this book and not even know what it was about. And then all of a sudden they're being told that psychedelic substances are no longer put in this category of bad or illicit substances and are now being put in a category of medicines. And so what does that do? You know, there's a cultural impact that happens. There's a personal impact there as well.
So I kind of came up in the rave scene and then the festival scene. And something like an MDMA is now we're seeing this enormous efficacy for working with post-traumatic stress disorder. And yet, you know, I think we've all had that experience of the Molly Goblins on the dance floor, just like sticking fingers in bags and just desperately trying to like add a high onto a high, onto a high, onto a high. And so can it be this same substance that is helping war veterans finally get their lives back and proving to do so more effectively than anything else that's available? Can that be the same thing that is potentially, you know, damaging people's, like, I'd always heard that MDMA was, you know, going to give you depression if you took too much. So again, kind of back to the pharmacon moment, is the difference between that way of doing it, that sort of like compulsive consumption, is that in the mentality of the user or is that in the culture, in like how the culture itself is holding the medicine and the container in which it's being used? How do we reorient people towards using these medicines in right relation in such a way that they can have these healing and personal growth properties rather than this sort of compulsive, like, I got to get high because my life isn't going so well and this allows me to escape?
So, yeah, you know, you reminded me of something that you were talking about with Veronica Gold, the importance of set and setting and how much that changes the substance that we're using. And one thing I think that is different with psychedelic substances rather than, for example, Ritalin, which is a pharmaceutical substance, is that it's undetermined and it's unexpected. And we can't know for sure exactly what kind of effect is going to happen. When you start using substances that impact the subconscious or just the conscious in general, there is no certainty. And I think that's what makes using these substances a little bit more difficult than other ones. But at the same time, another thing that you brought up here is using substances for fun. And a lot of what I am researching and writing about in this thesis is that perhaps with this protocol that is being built around psychedelic assisted therapy, and the focus that is being placed on the inner healer and our own innate will to heal ourselves, which is a lot of the language that is coming up within the clinical trials that's happening with MAPS and Johns Hopkins, if we're focusing on an inner healer, perhaps this can make recreational substance psychedelic use more legitimate. If we have an innate will to heal our own selves, then finding that connection within ourselves can be possible. And so, of course, as we mentioned, set and setting is extremely important, right? And in order to get these therapeutic values that you're speaking of, some kind of container, some kind of intentions might be necessary. But one thing that I have found very often is that there is a lot of negative connotation around recreational use versus therapeutic use. But I wonder sometimes, can't my recreational use be therapeutic? Is it not therapeutic for me to smile and laugh and dance and let go of whatever issues I'm feeling in that day. But of course, there's a line. Absolutely, there is a line between the intention to, okay, today is time for me to dance and be silly, and that's therapeutic, versus I need to take a substance every day or every weekend in order to escape. So again, we're going back to set and setting. We're going back to intentions, right?
Yeah, I think it's about whether we're doing this to connect with others and with ourselves, or we're doing it to escape others and ourselves. And I think, you know, talking about recreational use of psychedelics, my journey was very much like recreational to escape, then recreational in the context of like Burning Man and festivals to start to connect with people. And then ultimately, I started getting involved in medicine work in a ceremonial context, so specifically ayahuasca work, where now I rarely use psychedelics recreationally, not because that's, I have anything against it. It's just I don't need that in that way now. Like I like to put it in the ceremony space, and I get a lot more out of that. So I've definitely had that path and I've watched it, you know. And I think that, you know, what we're talking about right now is changing attitudes and changing paradigms. And in the journey that I had, it involved a changing paradigm. It involved starting with like, I'm going to do drugs because I feel lonely and I don't know who I am and I want to be someone that everyone likes. And that's a really lonely thing to be because that's a fundamental, it's fundamentally based on not liking myself. I mean, I think many of us have approached substances with that attitude. And then over time being like, well, actually, these substances are letting me connect more deeply. And there's something where I'm like, I feel like I'm like doing the work, you know, like I'm kind of like growing, I'm like using them in this way. And then along the way, changing the attitudes of my parents and the people in my life. And now obviously, you know, we both work for a psychedelic medicine company. So, you know, my parents are very on board with the work that I now do in this space. So there's been this process of personal transformation. And so I want to go back to your research from that perspective, because I kind of feel like we're all fighting the good fight of changing perspectives by changing our own and those around us. And many of the listeners are doing a similar thing. Many of the listeners who are involved in psychedelic healing started in a recreational space and are now trying to change that paradigm. So I think we can agree anecdotally that the pattern that I've just described tends to happen for me. I've seen it happen with other people. But you're doing like field research on this subject. So I'm curious what you've learned in doing that research. If there is kind of, if there are things that we can specifically be doing to change the paradigm, like what came out of the research for you?
I think one of the most valuable things I learned about the research that I did is learning how many people are truly in this very nuanced space that I mentioned before of being in 12-step recovery for a certain amount of time and wanting to use these substances and feeling like they're betraying themselves. For me, that was what stood out the most of all the research were those personal connections with these people who are struggling amidst this paradigm shift. And so what I conclude in my thesis is that if we're going to be integrating psychedelic assisted therapy into the world of biomedicine, we have to make sure that we do so ethically, which is a huge word, but we have to do so bearing in mind those who might be falling along the fringe and the sidelines of those who fit into this paradigm. There are people who are going to be struggling with this new paradigm. And that includes people who have this conception that psychedelic substances are bad. And in order to do that, I think in order to be quote unquote ethical on bringing this new paradigm into the world of biomedicine and Western medicine, we have to do a lot of education, a lot of community work, in my opinion. And so the work that I did when I did my field work was very much with the San Francisco Psychedelic Society. And as a result of that, I've since gotten very much involved with psychedelic societies around the world. Mike Margulies, he hosts Global Psychedelic Society meetings every month. And we meet with leaders from everywhere in Europe and Canada and America and all around. And in order to really work on this paradigm shift, we kind of need all aspects to come in together. And so we have the clinical trials, we have medicine, we have science that's doing their work. And that's probably the first step. But what I find is really necessary is the community and the education platforms that we're working on, where we can teach people about the convoluted nature of changing a paradigm shift.
So, Jessica, you're talking about a paradigm shift in the context of how addiction is treated. And we've been in this 12-step model, this abstinence recovery model, and there seems to be a lot of efficacy with psychedelic-assisted therapy. How does this paradigm shift from sort of absolute abstinence recovery model into psychedelic therapy? How does that happen? How is that happening?
A paradigm shift involves the interruption of conceptual continuity within science. And it involves some kind of revolutionary science interrupting the concepts that have been continuously told are facts. So that's what a paradigm shift means. And when we look at psychedelic assisted therapy and the way in which it prioritizes the inner healer, this is something that is very much interrupting the conceptual continuity that we have around the substance user being unable to make their own decisions. So a lot of the concepts that we have around substance users is that they don't have the ability to say no. They don't have the agency to say, oh, this is good drug use, this is bad drug use. And a lot of times within 12-step discourse, we very much remove that agency and that ability to make decisions from the substance user. And so what happens with psychedelic-assisted therapy and prioritizing that inner healer, we are very much doing the reverse of what traditional forms of managing addiction will do. And we are empowering the substance user rather than saying, you have no ability to make decisions. You are at your lowest low. You need to find a higher power in order to recover, which is what the 12 steps encourages. We are saying that higher power is within you. We, as in the psychedelic assisted therapy. And that in itself is a paradigm shift and very much troubles our categories around care. So what happens, which I find is very interesting, is that we are displacing certain concepts of the previous structure around managing addiction, but we are also simultaneously conserving certain aspects. As we find in the big book on 12 steps, the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book. And this shows that there's a certain amount of personality change that is necessary in order to bring a certain amount of recovery. So what I am finding is that within psychedelic assisted therapy, we are still very much prioritizing this spiritual experience. And I question, perhaps this is a spiritual experience that people can use in order to incite this personality change that the big book itself encourages us to find in order to attain recovery. And what's really interesting is that Bill Wilson, who created the 12-step program, was very interested in using LSD in order to attain these levels of spiritual experiences. And he very much wanted to bring LSD into the program. And there's a lot of debate as to what really happened there because we don't have a lot of accounts or direct accounts of his experiences. But perhaps I wonder sometimes if psychedelic assisted therapy could be very well integrated into the 12-step program rather than being feared, which is where it currently stands.
Yeah, I'd heard that about Bill W. and
and his interest in LSD. I really love the idea of it's like include and transcend in paradigm shifts. It reminds me a bit of spiral dynamics, the sort of thing where it's like, it's not that it is better. It's not that you're progressing into a better hierarchy, but it's sort of like an evolution where it's like taking the pieces that are working and bringing in new things and kind of evolving in that way. And I think for a lot of people who are in 12-step programs who are having the experience of like the dry drunk or like they're abstinent, but they're still suffering, there is this opportunity to connect to self that is available with psychedelics that could be enormously helpful for people and help to alleviate suffering. And that's what we all want.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, all a big answer to that question that my partner asked me. Am I still considered to be in recovery if I'm using psychedelics? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah. And I appreciate you bringing in the psychedelic societies because I wanted to talk a bit about this. Do you know much about the history of psychedelic societies?
I'm actually not entirely familiar with the beginnings of it, of the psychedelic societies on an international level. But I do know that there was, I believe, I can't recall his last name, but his name was Daniel, and he was in the San Francisco psychedelic community and the world there. And I believe it was him and Mike Margulies, and I could be wrong here. I'm sorry, Mike, if you're listening. But they started building these societies a little bit. Unfortunately, Daniel also passed away of an overdose, I believe with fentanyl as well. And since then, Danielle Negrin, who is now the executive director of the San Francisco Psychedelic Society, has taken it up from him and is very much doing the work in honor of him. So I know that that's how a lot of this started in North America, for instance. And I know that Mike has helped quite a few societies get off the ground. And then I also know that Stephen Reed in the UK has done a lot of work in terms of building websites that have all of the lists of the psychedelic societies. But in terms of the conception and the birth of who thought of doing this international community, unfortunately, I don't know. And I wish I did. Maybe I should.
Well, you know, and it sounds like it's probably an emergent kind of property of psychedelics themselves, is that there's this desire to create community. One of the things that I love about the space of psychedelics is that it does feel like an international community, particularly as we're getting more mainstream recognition. There's the old guard of, you know, psychedelic stewards who've been toiling away trying to change perspectives for a long time. And now we're sort of hitting a threshold point that we call the psychedelic renaissance. And it's, you know, it's such lovely words. We have societies and a renaissance, and it's all very romantic. You mentioned earlier that executive directing doesn't require so much because you have such a great team. But what is it that the Montreal Psychedelic Society does?
Well, the mission of the Montreal Psychedelic Society is to provide people with a space to connect with like-minded individuals. We want to provide people with a community where they feel that others have experienced something similar as them and that they can, as a result, connect with them. What often happens is a psychedelic substance will change somebody's life, for lack of a better word. We'll show them something and that incites them to heal in some way. And what often happens in those cases is the people around them are not also using psychedelics, and they find themselves in a space that they are very isolated and confused because they can't come out of the psychedelic closet. And they come into our events and they say, wow, I didn't know that there were other people who were using psychedelics. And that in itself is very wholesome, because that alienation feeling is very unsettling, especially after a psychedelic experience. So we hold 4 to 5 events each month, most of them being integration circles where people can talk about their experiences and can make meaning of their psychedelic experiences. We also hold a harm reduction education meeting, where we tell people about best practices of using psychedelic substances and the safest ways to do so. Then we also hold an MPS Academy, which is the Montreal Psychedelic Society Academy. And this is where one of our board members, Manash Gurn, who is a neuroscientist, teaches everybody about the latest things that's happening within academia and psychedelics. And then we also hold a book club just for people to read about psychedelic substances and to talk to each other. So the whole point of the Montreal Psychedelic Society is for people to just connect and learn and see that there are other people within their own city who are interested in using these substances.
I love that. I didn't realize that there were so many offerings. I know about these societies, but it's funny, I'd never really thought about like what y'all actually do. And it sounds like it's such a great way of bringing people together and making people feel safe and connected. Are there a lot of people involved in the Montreal Psychedelic Society who are involved in what you would call like psychedelic therapy, either as practitioners or receiving therapy, or is it more kind of recreational use?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Because I've had the pleasure of working in multiple societies in different cities, I can say that the Montreal Psychedelic Society is particularly consists of recreational psychedelic users. I think Montreal is a party city, does have a lot of young people who like to use substances. And for the most part, our audience consists of these young people who are curious about substance use in general. I would say in comparison, in the San Francisco Psychedelic Society, when I was attending their events, they had a much wider range of different types of people coming into their integration circles, for example, very different age groups coming from different work backgrounds, for example. And that's something that was very inspiring to me, that when I came back to Montreal, I really wanted to work on that and to try and diversify our audience. But that's kind of hard to do, to reach a whole new audience. And with the many projects that I'm working on, I haven't yet succeeded at that.
You spoke a moment ago about ethics, and I know that you're really passionate about the ethical injection of psychedelics into mainstream society. What is the vehicle by which that is going to happen? When you think about ethics in the psychedelic space, what are some of the biggest concerns that you think that this burgeoning industry, this international community, what do we need to get right in terms of psychedelics, from your perspective, and this does not need to be comprehensive, but just off the top of your head, what are some of the aspects of psychedelic ethical considerations that it's incumbent upon us to not fail at?
I think the first thing I would say would be to be wary of psychedelic exceptionalism, which essentially means, you know, thinking that it's psychedelic substances that are better than other substances. I think that to me hits a particular chord because of what had happened with my best friend who was suffering with heroin addiction. I think it's very easy for us to walk around thinking that we're doing the best substances. And I would be very wary of that. The second would definitely be around access, making sure that as many people who want to access this type of therapy can. And as a subset of that, not only taking a medicalized standpoint on psychedelics, because that would also infringe on people's access to the substance, especially in the US where healthcare costs a lot of money. If somebody wants to use this substance and the only way that they can access it is through the healthcare system, then they might not be able to do so. So for that reason, there's a lot of different debate around whether or not we should decriminalize all psychedelic substances or all substances in general and versus medicalizing. And I think medicalizing might harm or might infringe on people's access to these substances.
Hmm. Yeah, I heard Dennis McKenna speak on this once, and he was saying that the model that he thought was best for psychedelics to enter into mainstream society was actually a religious model versus a medical model. And he had some interesting points about that. I wish I could recall exactly the talk, but I, in my own work with ayahuasca and psychedelic ceremony, it feels very much like a religious experience and like a psycho-spiritual experience. While there's like deep healing occurring, it's not through the existing medical system with insurance providers and these different sorts of, you know, but at the same time, there are important checks and balances that come in with having, you know, medical credentials, for example. So there's a lot to get right as we continue blossoming as a community. And I know that there's a lot of people, including yourself, who are working hard at conceptualizing and sharing information about what the best ways to do this would be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one other thing that I would add on to there is listening to our elders and learning from the people who have been in the space for longer than Michael Pollan's book has been around, for instance, and making sure that, you know, we're doing our research properly. I think one of the things that I'm a little bit concerned with and nervous about with the psychedelic space expanding is people coming into the space without having done their homework and perhaps platforming, you know, somebody who may have done harm onto somebody else, for example. And so that's why community is extremely important and we need to hold each other accountable, but at the same time, practicing doing so by calling people in rather than calling people out, for example. And I think educating ourselves is the least that we can do, and making sure that we are respecting the work that has been put into this movement to be what it is today.
Yeah, I love that. I think that, you know, that idea of calling people in is so important when we're talking about accountability. When we're in community and we're willing to do the work of holding people accountable, it's about strengthening the community and kind of teaching everyone through bringing people back to the fold who have strayed, so to say. When it's just about calling people out and kind of the sort of bickering and expulsion model, then what ends up happening is that people end up just doing their own thing without the benefit of the community guidance, and that can be more harmful still. So I really appreciate that perspective. And I appreciate what you're doing in the space, Jessica. I think you got a great head on your shoulders around all of these topics, and I'm glad that you are, you know, you have these important leadership roles. And the thesis is not yet complete, correct? You're in your final stages of it?
Yes, I'm in the very not fun stage of revisions, which can last forever.
Man, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, it's you. There's a great line, a work of art is complete, not when there is no more to add, but when there is no more to take away. Can't remember who said that. I wish I knew. But Godspeed on the revisions. And I'd like to close our Conversations on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast by offering my guests the opportunity to speak directly to psychedelic therapists themselves and the people in the space who are doing the good work of the good work. And I was wondering if you had any choice bits of wisdom you'd like to share with our psychedelic therapy audience today.
I suppose one thing I would love to say is keep doing the amazing work that you are doing. I thank you for being at the front lines of this movement. Given that we live in a biomedical kind of framework here in the West, without you, we wouldn't be moving where we are, for lack of a better word. I would also really just love to say, you know, just to mention that my work with Maya is equally a contribution to making sure that we introduce psychedelic assisted therapy into the world of biomedicine in the most ethical way possible. And in order to do so, we need to provide the right tools to the practitioners who are doing this amazing work. And I hope that by contributing to Maya, we can help these practitioners on a much larger scale.
Well, Jessica, how can people keep up with you, follow your work? I imagine the Montreal Psychedelic Society must have a website. Where can our listeners keep up with you?
Yeah, so we do have a website. It would be called the MontrealPsychedelicSociety.org. And you can find us on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Meetup. And as for me, you know, you could find me anywhere on the social. And I love connecting with all of the people of the community, spending time with people on calls. You know, I do a lot of that. A lot of people contact me and try and figure out how to get involved in the psychedelic community. And I love spending time with these people because of how many people have spent time with me, showing me how to come into the psychedelic community. So please reach out. I would love to connect with everybody in this community as much as possible.
Awesome. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for getting on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast with me today. It's been a real pleasure to get to know you a bit better and to learn more about your work and your thinking. And yeah, I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Eamon. It was really lovely.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.